Welcome to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's cooperative radio, airing live on unceded Coast Salish territories. Animal Voices is Western Canada's only animal advocacy radio program, bringing you all you need to keep you up to date on what's happening locally and abroad. From interviews with amazing changemakers around the world to news, events, and lifestyle. Animal Voices can be heard live every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and can be also be streamed at coopradio.org, or you can check out animalvoices.org for podcasts soon after airing. Today is Friday, April 3rd, 2015. Joining me in studio today, we have all the organizing team for this weekend's Greater Vancouver Zoo Protest. So we have Darren Chang.
Hello.
We have David Isbister.
Hi.
Megan Beatty.
Hi.
Welcome, everyone. And we also have Amir here on controls today.
Hello.
So today we'll start off by speaking about why we feel fighting against the zoo is important and standing up for these animals. And just share some disturbing facts about the zoo and some personal experiences that we've had in relation to the zoo. And again, why we feel that this is an important issue that needs to be addressed. We'll also speak with David Isbister, who you just heard his voice a few minutes ago. he's just going to be talking about his history of working with exotic animals, both in rescue and the pet trade, and why he, what he had learned and the poor ethics behind keeping these animals in captivity. So to start off today, Megan, you recently went to the zoo as kind of a research project for this upcoming protest. Do you want to tell us a bit about what you experienced there?
Yes. My friend Beck and I went to the zoo, and I actually just recently asked my mom just to double check to see if I've actually ever been there as a child, and I had not. So this was my first experience, and it sucked. It was horrible. We had specifically gone there to kind of ask questions of the employees and kind of be a bit incognito or spy work kind of thing. But I actually dropped the ball on that because I was so affected by the environment and just seeing all these animals and how sad they looked. And one main experience that I had was with the cheetah. Like, I have obviously never seen a cheetah in real life. And now I have, and I wish that I hadn't. I have three cats at home and just domestic cats, obviously. And just seeing her sit there and purring and just looking into her eyes, she looked so, so sad. And it was just, all I could say was sorry to her. And I just felt ashamed and embarrassed to be there and just... Yeah, it was just all in all a very sad, horrible experience. And I, you know, it was not very nice out, so there weren't very many people there. But I had to hold myself back from asking the families, why are you here? Like, what, mm-hmm. what are you, why would this be something you want to see? Because it obviously is so distressing and sad for the animals. So
yeah, it's mm-hmm. kind of just like a... arrogant. It's extremely arrogant that we think we should take animals out of their habitat and put them mm-hmm. behind a cage so we can gawk at them. Mm-hmm. It's pretty sad. Darren, sorry, did you have something to say?
No, I guess I could go next in terms okay. of sharing my own experiences visiting the zoo. I've been to, I guess, at least a couple of zoos as a child when I was in Taiwan. There's there's a pretty popular... pretty big zoo in northern Taiwan. So I guess I was kind of brought up in that culture where, you know, that's like the main tourist attraction. So I wasn't really critical of it. And I went as like part of the, I think I was in elementary school or even possibly even younger. So obviously like that whole indoctrination process in our educational systems that talks about these zoos as if they're actually there for education and conservation. So I wasn't really critical of it at all. And even when I went to the Greater Vancouver Zoo only 6 years ago, when I first came to Canada, that was like my cousin's family's idea, and they invited me along because they have a little boy. I just walked around, and something about it always really bothered me. But couldn't really quite like pin it down like exactly what it was. One of the clearest things that I remember was seeing the raccoons at the zoo, and they were in these kind of glass, they were behind these like glass kind of structures. And I think that's when I really kind of started asking some critical questions, like if raccoons are local to this area and they're kind of around already, like why are we keeping them in these tiny little spaces? But I think it's really when I kind of learned about animal exploitation through animal rights activism and started thinking critically about these issues that I realized, you know, this is all just exploitation and domination for profit. And then you learn about the history of zoos and how that was all part of, you know, colonization when imperialists would go to other countries and then they would kill a bunch of what they deemed to be exotic animals and then kidnap a bunch and bring them back and showcase, you know, like the trophies that they've won. So it's just, yeah, it's really awful. And I think that one of the most recent things that I've saw online that really hit me hard was really back home in Taiwan. So it's like, in a sense, kind of came full circle for me, was seeing this hippo that fell off the truck and just lying in the street suffering for hours and fell again when people tried to help him back onto the truck. And the entire thing just like, yeah, I was like crying in front of the computer. It was really sad. Yeah. And that's why we're fighting against captivity, because it's terrible.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned, too, is really important, the intersectional oppression that's related to zoos, too, the colonization and, of course, exploitation for all the animals that are currently living there, and just reinforce it. They just reinforce each other consistently. Yeah, I also went to the Greater Vancouver Zoo about 7 or 8 years ago, I think, with a friend, actually, who had worked at the zoo, and so I got a free pass in. And I went, and I was kind of at the same time just learning about animal behavior, and what I saw there was just really distressing. Animals circling, animals, you know, just not exercising their behavior, but just looking kind of lifeless in a lot of ways, and like they'd completely given up on everything, which are, you know, stress-based as well as learned helplessness, essentially. So at the time, I was kind of thinking, I was kind of justifying it in a way, saying, well, they're better off here than if they were just dumped, like, they couldn't survive in the wild, and trying to justify that. But yeah, with the animal activist framework, I mean, there's legitimate sanctuaries that, yes, they're not ideal for these animals, but they are much better than the conditions that they're living in, where they are displayed in, you know, extremely artificial environments, and they don't get any opportunity to express any natural behavior. So, yeah.
And I think the children that we take to these zoos and stuff, I don't think they really understand that this is not the natural behavior of a lot of these animals. You know, maybe they think this is normal for an animal to be acting this way and walking around in circles, but we're not really teaching kids that we're taking to the zoos that this isn't how they would be acting in the wild.
Mm-hmm. And I think Darren just released a video recently that he put together, kind of the stark contrast between the Vancouver Zoo animals inside the zoo as well as their, you know, wild counterparts, and how vast the difference is between the two and their behavioral differences. So it's kind of, you can't really ignore that once you see something like that. And so I recommend people check it out. It's on the Greater Vancouver Zoo protest page, and just, yeah, try to think about that and try to relate to the experiences of these animals. Did you have anything to say about this, David? Because I know you have experience related to it.
Yeah, like off of what Amir said, I think it's important to remember that the education excuse is more just about children being easily captivated and inquisitive and you know, innocent, you know. So you're going there and they see animals, and of course it's a great experience for them because they're not aware of the reality. But it's up to the parents and everyone else to captivate your easily captivated child any other number of ways, you know. Like there's experiences you can have in local rescue, in farm sanctuary, all around, that don't involve, you know, the exploitation of animals or people who are trying to address that problem. So it's true. Kids love animals, of course. Like, yeah, there's so many ways to give that to them, though, that doesn't involve enslaving, exploiting, and ultimately killing so many of these animals.
And we've got like so many good, you know, media sources now in HD. Like, you know, you can, it's like you're just there in the desert in the wild with the animals. There's really no more excuses for zoos.
Yeah.
You don't have to see them in real life. I'm a nanny and I look after two little boys and we dress up, we play puzzles, we read books, we watch nature shows. You don't need to see them in real life to learn about them and get excited about them.
Or you could go, you know, take the trip of a lifetime and go to places that that actually ethically conserve them. And I think the way to, on the captivation point again, right, is just connecting to your local ecology. There's so much beauty here in our sea and on land, you know, animal wise.
Yeah, we actually live in one of the most diverse areas, which people don't often think about that. They're like, oh, I'm going to go to the tropics and see spider monkeys. It's like, well, we have a lot of animals here. You just don't respect them or acknowledge them in the same way. And I think just touching on, like the main topic that's coming up, which is, you know, I think it's important to nurture that, you know, desire and interest in animals that that children have, because you know, they're our future generation of activists. We don't want to show them animals in captivity and say, this is how you respect animals, because you hear kids, you hear adults going, I want that. Or I, you know, like they want to own these exotic animals. They want that. Like it's a possession. It's a possession. And that's how the zoo looks at them. And, you know, with all the countless deaths that have taken place at the Greater Vancouver Zoo and that they're trying to hide, like they don't have any respect for these animals. There's no, there's no way they can try to deny that. All right. Yeah. And on a different note, now that we're all heated about that, this past weekend, we did a demonstration with Direct Action Everywhere. And we went into Whole Foods and it was a quite the demonstration. We had activists that were slaughtered, in air quotes. They weren't actually killed. They were slaughtered artificially for a theatrical type performance. And Megan, who's here today, read a beautiful poem, which she's going to share with us on air.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay, now I can read it. I won't have to memorize it. Okay. Newborn girl, yellow fluff, searing pain, beak burnt off. Valued only by her weight, why has this become her fate? She cannot stand, her legs are splayed. No one deserves to be treated this way. Ammonia burns, cages of flesh. When she's spent, she's gassed to death. Darkness and death is what awaits her. What if they killed your daughter? Useless, discarded, ground-up garbage. Bagged alive to suffocate in darkness. Does no one hear their cheeps and cries? Being born a male for little chicks, life is only a few tick-ticks. Their life is too short to already be over. What if they killed your brother? Impregnated, unnatural, violated, artificial. Newborn calf stolen, mother wailing, udder swollen. Rolled away in a wheelbarrow, no loving touch, just lonely sorrow. Baby alone, in a dark crate, whitest meat is what kidnappers like. Iron bars licked, anemia takes hold. The end is not far, he soon will be sold. When dairy mum is pumped dry, sick and tired or fallen over, on your dinner plate she'll lie as she too is sent off to slaughter. Only darkness and death is to come. What if they killed your mum? Stench and filth, mutilation, distress and heartbreak, no cessation. Mothers confined to farrowing crates, cold and dirty iron bars separate, no familial bonds to create. Tail docking, overcrowding, castration, no numbing. Panicked, squealing, misery in stereo. This is the only life they know. Only in death will this all end. What if they killed your friend? All these fallen beings around us, they are just like us. They feel pain and sadness. They feel joy and happiness. They are your mother, your daughter, your brother. They are your friends and family. They are you. They are me. We are all the same. There's no separation. We are all equal. Please see the connection.
Thanks so much for sharing that, Megan. You hear their applause in studio. I find that poem really powerful. And I think it can change a lot of hearts and minds. And it's an important thing to think of, especially with the so-called Easter holiday coming up this weekend. Mm-hmm. Just think about the exploitation that goes into the activities and possibly the meals that you are partaking in. And we will now play a song by Regina Spektor called You've Got Time. You may recognize it if you've watched Orange is the New Black, but it relates definitely to animal captivity, which is our topic today.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
So we have David Isbister joining us here today in studio. He is the chef and founder behind plant-based food and natural products. So I recommend checking it out, but that's not why he's here today.
Nope.
David has a history of many years ago working in and learning all about exotic animals, particularly exotic pets and reptiles. He has since cut ties with these exploitative industries, but still carries a vast knowledge in all things involving these animals. David is also part of the core organizing team for the Greater Vancouver Zoo protest this Sunday at 11:30, which I did mention earlier, but I thought I'd mention it again. Mm-hmm. So, David, can you start by telling me what caused you to develop an interest in exotic pets?
I just had a sort of nerdy streak to me going through my, my teens. And ever since I was a kid, I used to, we lived in Poco sort of before it was developed growing up, and there was a lot of garter snakes there. And I had a fascination with snakes when I was a kid. I used to sort of pick them up and temporarily bring them home to show my mom and try to scare her, but she would actually just be like, oh, it's so cute. And so it, we just kind of started just basically going on hikes and finding, you know, salamanders and snakes just kind of innocently growing up, and it kind of blossomed from there. I went to a pet store when I was 17 in Surrey Central Mall, and they had a really mean baby boa constrictor there, and I offered to tame it for him, and I did. I settled the snake down and was good at handling, and from there it just kind of took off. I just got really, really into it and started reading everything about common pet trade animals, writing my own care sheets, and slowly got to realize that they were selling these animals, which at the time I didn't disagree with. I didn't really know better. But they didn't have proper care for them. So that's kind of the angle I entered in with some practical knowledge I wanted to improve care sheets and sort of help pet stores restrict like the sales of iguanas and other problematic animals. Animals I saw at the time as problematic for me to keep, so they should be tough for anyone else to keep, you know.
Mm. And what areas, you kind of touched on it, but what are some of the areas that you worked in involving exotic quote-unquote pets?
So the bulk of what I did early on was handling. I did handling of snakes and tortoises mostly, and some arachnids in movies. So I did work for CBC. All the major places, all the major studios were in play then. So I'd have a few animals, mostly rescues and some that at the time I had purchased, and that I would take out and make money from handling them in movies. Yeah. From there, I didn't like that because a lot of times they just want me to store the animal in like a cooler somewhere, which is how snakes are commonly transported, like in a cooler usually. And they wouldn't provide heat. And so I started becoming more selective. I started only doing CBC because they would give a heated trailer, you know, or I would do I wouldn't do outdoor shoots or, you know, things slowly started encroaching on my ability to feel right about making money from this. You know, I just started noticing things like, oh, this isn't actually what I know about the species. This isn't good for it, you know. So I went into oddly pet trade, and I thought I could sell them to families and people who knew what to do with them, who would take my advice. And my intentions were at the time, to me, I felt they were definitely noble. I wanted to help rewrite bylaws. I reached out to various rescues and did work on the side, took animals in myself, and started to address the problem in a way I thought that was okay. Yeah. As like a 19-year-old fella. You know?
And what caused you to leave the area of work? You kind of touch on it, but can you elaborate a bit?
Yeah. I mean, I'll elaborate, but the header sentence for it is that essentially most of the people involved are just terrible. Mm-hmm. I don't want to paint everyone with a brush. There's lots of nice people I met in the pet trade who do care about animals, but they also all had this sort of strange pathology to just accept that sometimes stuff died and it just gets sick and you can't help it and we can't afford vet care and that's just how it is because it's a store. Mm-hmm. You know, and I started getting angry at that. So I worked in a store, a huge store. I had quite an excellent opportunity. I worked in a store where I managed 55,000 gallons of water, like with fish, various marine and tropical hobby fish, and 4,000 square feet of enclosures for reptiles. It was a huge store in Richmond. And I changed the sourcing. I changed pretty much everything. I got better animals in for sale. I did all these things that I thought would address it. But time after time, people just kept coming in and killing all my stuff. You know, they'd buy a half-assed enclosure and take it home and come back and ask for their money back after the thing died. Or fish were treated like these. Oh, if it dies, we'll just buy another one. And I'm like, that's like goldfish, you know? That's a fish that can live 60, 70, 80 years in like a proper environment, you know? It's a carp, you know? So stuff like that really started eating at me. So the next thing I did was I went into wholesale. I thought, okay, well, now I'll source the animals myself. Everyone here is grinning at me, I know. But I'll source them. I know all the good breeders now, all the people that are super, super moral like me and will do it right, you know? And sure enough, the guy I ended up working for was probably the most prominent local importer and supplier. And he was renowned. His fish and reptiles were much more expensive than anyone else's on the wholesale level. And one day I was sitting in the office and setting up a reptile section for him, and he offhandedly remarked that he had set up another large aquarium company several years earlier. It's a big aquarium services company that's kind of all through North America. And he said, "Oh yeah, we blew up all of the Florida reef getting all those fish out of there. We made a fortune." And I said, "Oh, blew up the reef?" And he's like, "Yeah, yeah, you just little explosions." And later on I realized that he was actually talking about an exceptionally illegal practice, which is like bomb fishing, right? You put in small charges and then tropical fish that are fancied by hobbyists float to the top. You net them and they die 3 months later. You know, so they were just selling these temporary pretty objects for rich people's tanks. And it just started eating at me. So, I have to mention, the whole time I was vegan too, I didn't quite understand, you know, I hadn't developed my activist streak at that point, really. I thought I had, you know, I would intervene and take animals back from people, and I would find new houses for things. I did the best I could, but the more you're in it, the more you try to find an angle that's suitable for even just a basic morality that animals should be treated with respect, it's just not possible.
Yeah, and yeah. I think you kind of touched on a lot of things, like that the yeah, stores. Sorry. No, it's good. Like these stores, they see animals as, you know, stuff, and
it's
essentially
a unit.
Stock.
Yeah,
they're
it is.
Stock.
That's what it's called. Yeah.
So they can't have respect for them, and they can't have, you know, any worry about their interests. Really, they're just objects to them, like you mentioned.
They're a thing that goes along with $300 to $600 worth of dry goods with sales, right? That's a thing that enables you to buy all that other stuff.
Mm-hmm. And like where, like you mentioned, where the some of the fish came from, but where are most of the other? I guess it can range a lot, but a lot of them are wild caught, captive bred, or
so. The wholesaler I worked for at the end, I sourced from this one place out of Toronto that most pet stores use, this place in Toronto is infamous. You know, if you ever asked him to send you a picture of the reptiles, he'd give you this disgusting, you'd see this disgusting tank filled, like just crammed full. And it started kind of raising my eyebrow, you know, I started kind of raising my eyebrows and kind of saying like, well, those look wild caught. And he's like, oh yeah, but people can't tell, you know, like they don't, you know, they've been demited. I'm like, okay. But I mean, they're wild caught. Like I can look that they're definitely not. And he's like, yeah, but I mean, it's a Chinese water dragon, right? Like, that's how everything was responded to. Yeah, but I mean, like, if you wanted a captive bred Chinese water dragon, that's going to cost you wholesale $100. You're not going to sell that for $300. You know, like, it just became like, what would be the most money you could get for the animal? So what I was forced to end up doing was bringing in essentially sick animals with maladaptivity and various parasitic issues. So I tried to address it too. I bought a microscope. I did parasitology, various tests. I learned how to do all these things to try to address it, rehabbing the animals, and still everything died, and everyone bought it, and it just died, and it was just a parade of death. I think I digressed, but
no, that's great. And can you tell us a bit about, since you mentioned wild caught specifically, what their experiences are like, you know, in captivity versus the wild, and how that affects them?
Mm-hmm. So reptiles in general, like as far as care goes, there's so many ranges. If one comes from a cloud forest, then they need humidity and wet substrate, you know, or damp substrate. If it comes from a desert, it needs something drier and non-particulate or packed, you know, like there's all these things that you have to consider. But when you take an animal from the wild, especially, it immediately becomes maladaptive. It's a stress response. They take usually hundreds of them at once, put them in a cloth bag, put them inside of a crate, and then they ship them right. I mean, there's farms in Africa, for instance, that just hatch pythons, so they can call them captive hatched, but they're actually just wild collected eggs. They just go and hunt eggs and then incubate them and hatch them. So all of them, I mean, I had an order of pythons come one time, like 20 of them, that all just died immediately of bacterial infection because they had all been traveling. They had no defenses left. Reptiles, basically, if they're captive bred and they know they're captive bred, that they're less maladaptive. But even still, they're very sensitive. Certain species aren't, but I found that almost every species, someone will find some way to easily kill it. You know, but in the case of the wild caught stuff, they immediately become distressed, very distressed, dehydration. They come with a host of parasites because in the wild that's what they're dealing with. And they get overtaken by those things because they can't outrun it. They don't have space and they're concentrated, all pushed together. Mm. It's a terrible experience. They're frightened. They're dying by crushing, by just being forced into a small container, you know, or they deliver them in little plastic containers, little tiny snakes in little like ramekins for restaurants, you know, just being treated like a side dish, you know, like just like something that just happened to show up in a box, you know?
And like you again, kind of touched on, many people tend to purchase exotic animals, reptiles and other animals as novelties because they're different, but they don't really fully realize the amount of care and attention they require, which can lead to suffering, death or abandonment of these animals. Why is it so easy for novice people with no experience to acquire these animals, and where do they most often end up?
Okay, so it's easy to acquire for them because the barrier to entry is overall decently low. For instance, if you get a dog, you're paying money every day, every week, you know, toys and leashes and food and every, you know, it's kind of a more, you might not buy so much at the beginning, but you keep on coming back. Reptiles, people usually have to take on a large expense in the beginning, a tank, a heat pad, a lamp, substrate, caves, you know, decor, whatever they normally buy for them now. And it can run you a lot, you know, the reptile, say, as a snake, $200 and the setup, you know, $400 or $500 to do it properly. So then they just start thinking like, well, I put all my money in. It's good. That's all he needed. He said he was just going to be fine after that. You feed him a mouse every week and that should be cheap and I don't really want to. But that reduces their perceived value to people. The fact that they don't reach out and they don't engage with you, that they prefer to be left alone, that they prefer to hide, that they're predominantly nocturnal, like a lot of the snakes that are fancied in hobby. So it's easy for people to imagine like, oh, he's nocturnal. He doesn't need a lot of attention. He doesn't need to be handled. The barrier to me continuing to own the snake is low. Once I have the heat lamp, he'll be warm. You know, like that's kind of the mindset around it. I mean, they don't realize how large the animals can get, how needy they can get, and how hard it is to find veterinary care. There's maybe two places that'll take you right in. You know, it's expensive all around. Anything that goes wrong is really expensive, and that's why they get abandoned, is they get a simple problem like mites or dehydration or you know, infected scales or something from poor care, and the person doesn't want to admit that they in the end don't know anything about it and they didn't listen to anybody and they just wanted a cool snake to freak out their friends or whatever, you know, like it just becomes a prop, and that's why they get abandoned so much. And then people get nervous too, they bite, you know you'll take anyone who's ever owned a snake, you're going to get bit at some point, you know, even if they're the awesomest snake ever or whatever, you know. So it's just all around very sad.
And that kind of, I was going to actually ask you too, in relation to the biting, caiman were a big trend a few years ago.
Oh my God.
And they are essentially an alligator, but pet stores would sell, crocodilian, pet stores would sell them. And, I also have a similar background to David, and I worked a bit in rescue with exotics rescue, quote unquote. And yeah, they would bite the kids. They can grow to be 6 feet. Like they are not domestic animals. Sorry, that was a bit of a side point, but right. I just thought that was important to mention. And another thing related to care is people often, you know, adopt parrots because they can talk to them, or turtles, which often outlive the people that are caring for them. And then what happens to those animals often?
Yeah, so are you talking about turtles, like aquatic, or tortoises?
Turtles or tortoises.
Okay.
Yeah.
So turtles for the most part just get dumped in local waterways and ponds. Turtles have been outlawed, or, you know, through bylaws and other practices through a lot of municipalities. That's something I worked on early, is they carry a lot of salmonella. They're very, very, they just produce so much poop. Those little turtles, boy, are they cute, but they get big quick, and they just are a mouth and a butt, and that is pretty much a mouth, butt, and a shell. So people dump them. They get too big. They don't want to buy a big tank. And then tortoises, their diet is very, very, very misunderstood. Most of the ones that are fancied require like a very specific mixture of greens and vegetation, and people just aren't willing. They just throw iceberg lettuce in. Same thing happens. The health deteriorates, and they start looking for a place to dump it, saying that, oh, it's sick and I can't afford it, when really it was from their own neglect and refusal to understand the huge complexity it takes to care for an animal that seems relatively simple. Mm. Yeah. Oh, it's cute. He just walks around. You know, he'll just hide in a shell if he's scared. I'll give him some lettuce. I mean, I've seen it over and over. Like, oh, I feed him romaine and red peppers. I'm like, okay, so he's dying. Like, just people refusing to understand, you know, and they end up, tortoises usually get resold. There's usually a fancier out there or something who's hoarding them. They tend to get sold to animal hoarders. Reptiles especially attract people who can hoard them because they can stack. Mm-hmm. You know, you can put these giant rigs together that are just essentially shoeboxes on runners in a baking rack system, you know, and you just suspend enclosures 10 high and 50 across. And there's people who have these rooms in their house, and it's just filled with a collection of hoarded animals. So that's usually where they end up. Big ones tend to go out to people who have bigger properties and just want to stick them in their yard and hope for the best.
And is that all legal for that? Like, what happens if an investigator discovers one of these places, right?
So until recently, it was totally legal. You could own an African spur thigh tortoise, which is a tortoise that gets to be like 300 pounds, could live. I mean, they have them documented living well past 100.
Wow.
And they take a fair while to get that size. But once they start going, they go. But the laws have changed now, I believe, to exclude spur thighs and other like geoshalone, the pet trade tortoises. Mm-hmm. I think red foots are still available because they're relatively small. But the two larger ones have been limited. But people, it's so easy to get your hands on one. Yeah. I mean, you could just have it mailed to you from anywhere that it's legal to sell.
Mm. I was going to mention, like, about the dumping, especially of turtles. My partner, who works at an SPCA, had a box turtle brought into her at the SPCA mm-hmm. that someone found at a pond.
Mm-hmm.
And box turtles are actually land. They're terrestrial. Yeah. So it was kind of interesting. Luckily, which I'll talk to you more about later, the turtle was brought to an actual rescue and has a better life now.
But box turtles were also finally banned in most municipalities because they can adapt so quickly and so well. They're from such a wide range of terrain. Mm-hmm. Those ones were always turning up for me too. Box turtles were always coming through the door. Do you guys want this, or can I trade it for a snake or whatever, you know?
And with the SPCA enforced bylaw, which was government proposed by the government,
mm-hmm.
Regarding changes to exotic animals, how has it impacted these animals? Has it been a positive change, or has it led to more abandonment mm-hmm. or euthanasia?
So there's like a few problems with it. I can't profess to be like a huge expert on the ins and outs of all of it, because I left it entirely just as that was coming in. But what I noticed, and what I know from friends as well who are still involved in other ways, is that it went really underground, because the government asked you to submit a form detailing every animal you owned, and then you would have to ask for an exemption. If not, you'd have given them all your information, and they could just show up and probably seize it. Mm-hmm. So seizures did happen. They took like larger things, rock pythons, Burmese. There was people who lost their pets, and they were euthanized, just sort of right away. And then other places, other people sort of thought ahead, and they ditched them at sanctuaries, zoos. Actually, relating to the Greater Vancouver Zoo, they've taken people's pets on a number of occasions, right? If they don't have one in their collection, it doesn't surprise me for a zoo to do that. But even through like zoo channels, if they were sort of obeying their own so-called morality about it, they would trade only with other zoos, which of course isn't better, but still, it's just funny how they're willing to ban. So There's people involved in sort of pseudo rescue out in the valley that also sell animals and defend the zoo because they take in people's pets and they feel that that would enable the sales of other animals or it being okay, you know.
And so what are your thoughts on groups that call themselves rescues but actually tour around and essentially run a business off the backs of exploiting these animals? How can they even call themselves rescue?
Well, they can't and they shouldn't, to be totally honest. The thing that sort of offends me the most is there's a couple of places I know that are at, from one side of their mouth, they say, it's the pet stores and the breeders and everyone else but me who is the problem. I rescue these animals. And yet, in a couple of places in the valley, they're selling animals they breed in-house at their rescue. And one of them had a post where he had claimed that he had euthanized 50 turtles to make way for more turtles in the same bogged down pond. Like, rescue to me personally, my having my experience that I had, should be from a position of no kill, number one, and taking only what you can actually rescue and working your damnedest to find homes for everything else you can't. You know, but in a proper no-kill, non-profit, non-sale, education at the facility only. No, reptiles do not travel well. Some are tolerant and docile, but that is not a measurable stress response. Reptiles are stressy, sensitive, easily maladaptive animals, all of them, across the board in their own way.
Mm-hmm. And some of these rescues also have been known to take really rare species of reptiles and use them more as a show advertisement, I guess.
Like a zoo, like a roadside zoo, like just at one big attraction.
Exactly.
Hey, I've got this thing.
Exactly.
You know?
And what are some local actual legitimate rescues? And I'm saying this not advocating that anyone take home a exotic animal, unless, of course, they are well equipped. And what my question was is that you would recommend to people that feel they have the knowledge and care requirements to provide.
So for me, the only person you're talking about where they would go
to adopt one or to bring an animal that they may have come across.
For me, it's really only the Richmond Reptile Refuge, run by Val. I forget her last name. Sorry, Val, if you're out there. She's no kill, no sale, and is very hesitant to do any placement. So if you go there knowing your stuff or wanting to volunteer or wanting to actually learn about how we've just destroyed so many species worlds, then that's a good place to start, and then you could decide what animal might suit you. Reptiles are it's weird because, I mean, I come from a place in the past of having enjoyed owning them. I honestly did, you know, before I knew it was I was a great owner of reptiles. I was skilled. I knew how to treat basic, you know, issues and whatnot, but overall it's just not right.
Yeah,
there's just not enough knowledge at everyone's at that level. Like, no one really wants to do that. They just want to know, like, when do I feed it, how much water does it drink.
And I think, you know, I think even if we do have the knowledge, we are still these animals are not domesticated, most of them, and we're taking them out of their home and putting them in this unnatural environment where they are not meant to live. And so it's I don't believe that they can have a fulfilling life in captivity. There again, we've already created this problem. We do need to take care of the ones that already exist. Mm-hmm. And so that is
100%.
That is something that we need to keep in mind.
I would start with Richmond.
Great.
Yeah.
And what can people do aside from adopting or, otherwise to help out exotic pets?
So generally speaking, the number one thing you can do is voice your opposition to anyone that sells them. Refuse to shop there. Do not buy supplies from people that sell live animals. Do not be complicit with the sale of reptiles. Don't advocate for others to acquire reptiles. And when you go to a store and you see cages full of reptiles, Chances are, if you have a good look around in there, you're going to see one that's messed up. You know, blisters, abscesses, mites. I haven't been into a pet store that sells live animals in so long. I voice my opposition, but I just can't do it. I used to go in, and so I've sent other people in and get them to tell me what they see, and then I call them in.
Yeah.
There's several stores around town that I can think of there's one in particular in Burnaby that is just has a legacy of absolute horror, and I send people there all the time to check for me. But it's important to go in, and if you see something, say something. Mm-hmm. Please, if you're wrong, it's okay. They, you know, follow up with you, SPCA or Humane Society. They'll follow up with you and say, we checked it out. It looks okay to us. And you can say, okay, there's no risk to you personally. There's no risk to you legally. Just phone it in and get it looked at.
Great. And I think it's also important too. There's so many, well, not so many, but there's occasionally demonstrations against pet stores in relation to selling dogs and cats. Mm-hmm. But I think this is also an issue that we can address with activism too, is, you know, just go out to the pet stores that sell these exotic animals, parrots, reptiles, you know, every type of animal that we could just generally do a protest for any pet store just saying stop selling animals, really.
Mm-hmm. I mean, 100%.
That's the problem, is they're selling animals, they're making money off live creatures. So thanks so much, David, for sharing all your knowledge with us on these issues that, again, are likely not on the radar of many activists, but I think should be. And Darren, you had some events for us.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to quickly announce this one event. This is happening tomorrow, Saturday, April 4th at Capilano University. And it's the first ever International Bear Day. And it's co-organized by Raincoast Conservation Foundation and North Shore Black Bear Society. Basically, it will be a fun family event it's from noon till 4 p.m. And as you know, face painting, presentations, music, bear safety presentation, and also at 6:30 to 9:30, there's going to be a presentation. It's related to bear research and conservation, and they'll have experts there sharing their knowledge. Yeah, and of course, this Sunday is our Greater Vancouver Zoo protest.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We haven't talked enough about it. Sunday, 11:30.
When is that? Is that this Sunday? Is this coming up? It's coming up. This Sunday coming up, eh?
In Aldergrove. Mm-hmm. In Aldergrove. Okay. Check out our Facebook page, Greater Vancouver Zoo Protest. Mm-hmm.
We'll be meeting around 11:30, and we'll be marching to the zoo from the meeting location at noon.
Awesome.
Roots Reggae, heard every Friday night from midnight till 7 a.m. This is where we spread a little one love message, reminding you to lift as you climb. Don't leave anyone behind. So get on board the reggae train and let's take it to a higher level. Roots Reggae, filled with substance, yet substance free. Check us out online at www.coopradio.org. Tell your neighbors, tell your family and friends, it's commercial free and full of vibes. There's a message in the music, and the music is the message. Roots Reggae, every Friday night from midnight till daylight.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio, broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
Okay, so I'm going to continue with some news. One of the major ones that happened this week was the Halsik First Nations had a victory against the Department of Fisheries and Oceans when they occupied the DFO's office to basically stop the restarting of the herring fishery in their territory, because the fishery has been just completely overfished and exhausted, and the indigenous people are trying to protect it and allow the population to basically repopulate and actually survive. And yeah, after occupying their office and hours of talk with DFO representatives, they declared a victory, I think, yesterday or the day before. So that's really good news for the fish, for the ocean. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. And another good news, this happened, I think, late last week. Another orca calf was born in a local pod, the J pod, and that brings the total population up to 81 orcas. And yeah, just this year alone, there has been four. This is the fourth birth in 3 months. Mm-hmm. So that's, yeah, great news.
Not used to this much good news on Animal Voices.
Do you want some bad news as well?
No.
No, they really aren't. No, not for today. Yeah.
So that's great. I mean, yeah, 81 is still pretty low, so we still need to do as much to protect our oceans as we can, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's still an endangered population or threatened population there.
Yeah, for sure. And we also, we have a couple minutes, so why don't we talk more zoo talk?
Yeah, one of the things I did want to mention, just building off of what David mentioned earlier, in terms of knowledge, I think the same thing, the exact same logic could be applied to captive animals in zoos, just that how little we actually know about many of these species. Totally. And I want to mention last year, a programs manager, a representative from the Born Free Foundation in the UK, Chris Draper, came to UBC to give a talk. And that's actually one of the main arguments he made in the presentation against captivity, was that if you look at the diversity of species out there and how many of them are just wild caught and brought into the zoo, we really know way too little about them to justify any sort of confinement and keeping them in captivity. Mm-hmm. And this is coming from somebody who is sort of working within the system and as sort of like reformist, obviously with end goal of ending captivity as a whole, but even just like making suggestions to scientists and experts out there saying like, no, we can't justify capturing any animals and holding them in captivity. So that talk was actually recorded. And if you just Google Chris Draper, UBC, you know, animal welfare presentation or something, you can see the whole talk on there. I think I highly recommend that. But yeah, and going back to, that's why we're protesting the zoo.
And yet another reason. The reasons never stop.
No.
Yeah, and I think that's so important to remember too, is we, even, you know, the zoo, they have their signs about how they're, you know, conserving their, these animals, but they're also lying about their life expectancies on those things. Mm-hmm. And they're, a lot of the facts that they're supplying are actually, they're perhaps accurate, but they're spun in a way that makes the zoo seem positive.
They're favorable to the
exactly.
zoo.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, like, I remember one example where it said, I think the Arctic foxes lived to be like 3 years old, which if you research it a bit more, it's, that's their, the highest rate of predation. So a lot of them in the wild will be killed off before that time. But if not, they can live to be up to 15 years. So
they do that too. They with Sweetie, the Siberian tiger. Sorry to step on you there.
No, go ahead.
With the Siberian tiger on my timeline that has been posted in the zoo protest there. This one, she was euthanized because of general health issues at the age of 14. But they mentioned she met her average lifespan. But the funny thing is the average lifespan is 20 to 30 for the most part. So they're using the lowest possible number, 15, for a wild animal, and then saying that their captivity rate, which should technically be higher because you can keep the animal, I guess, unhappy, but adequately enough that they live longer because there's no predator stuff happening, you know? So I just find there's lots of that all through the timeline where I've noticed that they reference one lifespan, and it's not even the reality.
Yeah, and I don't know any humans either that would rather live longer, unhappy,
in solitary confinement,
enslaved lives than shorter.
Like the
free
length
lives.
Of life has nothing to do with the overall care or the fulfillment of the animal.
Captivity is suffering, and captivity kills, and that is our end message for today. So you've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's Co-op Radio, airing live on unceded Coast Salish territories. Next week's show will have some special programming related to National Wildlife Week, so tune in. And in the meantime, we at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Visit animalvoices.org, where you can download our shows as podcasts, like our page at facebook.com, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And we do want to hear from you. So if you have any comments or questions, either just let us know either on Facebook or by emailing radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Any suggestions, any ideas, we're open to feedback. And we're closing the show today with a song entitled Passion for Freedom by True Nature, which talks about all the animals suffering in captivity, whether in zoos or otherwise. So stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith, and thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices, and be kind to the animals.
To break for all enslaved.